What's interesting is the way, in some ways, that these issues have persisted, although the Republicans who used to be in favor of tariffs are now against them. And the Democrats, to be honest, are deeply divided on this subject. So at this point in Kennedy's speech, the hall was darkened and the pictorial illustrations of Mr. Kennedy's argument began. To show the less fortunate conditions of people in other countries, views were given which had been taken by Mr. Kennedy with his own Kodak, showing women yoked in harness with cows and dogs to do the work of horses and oxen, also women enormously burdened through the streets of the most brilliant capitals of Europe, acting as load carriers in Vienna and doing all the street cleaning in Munich. Then a portrait of Bismarck was shown, followed by a view of Bismarck's statement that prosperity of America is mainly due to its system of protective laws. So Europe was the bad Europe for the United States, even in the 1890s. All your economics, your social health, your health system, all this is very un-American, of course, and we have to be careful. And it goes back to the fact that you made all your women act like dogs and sheep and just terrible. Kennedy went on to use images as evidence to refute the Democratic Party's disparagement of tariffs as effective in stimulating local industries, with tin plate manufacture being his prime example. As the brief quotes that I've offered here suggest, Kennedy's lecture was very extensively covered. I almost want to say relocated, to use Francesco Cassetti's term, by the reliably Republican New York Tribune into newspaper form. The enthusiasm of Kennedy's assertions was challenged by the New York Times, which did some research and cited a letter to the editor that Kennedy had written to the New York Tribune, a Republican newspaper, in 1890. In it, Kennedy was quite critical of McKinley's tariff, particularly as it might impact on Republican chances in the 1892 presidential election. Minnesota and other Western states strongly opposed the tariff. Kennedy's earlier concerns, in fact, proved well-founded, for Cleveland won New York State and gained a second non-consecutive term as president. So the Democrat won, all these stereopticon lectures were for naught. And the Democrats, who rarely used the stereopticon in its campaigns during the late 19th century, won this one. So that sort of, I want to say, gives you an idea of the way to think of the way I was thinking of the stereopticon functioning in a larger media formation in which oratory, the political speech, is actually the paradigm under which it's really operating in relationship to the newspaper, in relationship not only to political oratory, but to political sort of public pageantry, the marches and so forth. In which the newspaper again is really playing the key role here, in terms of media in modern media in some ways. So, motion picture or cinema? What is a media form? Commercial motion pictures projected in a theatrical setting, what's become known as the cinema, effectively began in the United States on April 23rd, 1896, when Edison's Vitascope debuted. When Edison's Vitascope debuted at Carlson Biaz Music Hall in New York City. In Europe, of course, it began somewhat earlier, traditionally with the Lumiere's cinematograph opening at the Salon Indien du Grand Café on December 28, 1895. Of course, the introduction of modern motion pictures began somewhat earlier with the demonstration of Edison's kinetoscope at the Brooklyn Institute on May 10, 1893, or perhaps more credibly, on the opening of a kinetoscope parlor in New York City on April 14, 1894. The issue of such beginnings can be further complicated, of course, by definitions of motion pictures or modern motion pictures. Nevertheless, it does seem to me that, excepting perhaps André Gaudreau, we have not thought so carefully about how motion pictures can be said to be a media form. If Edison's motion pictures with the peephole kinetoscope offered an initial system of inventions that constituted a nascent media form, They became something more than a passing technological novelty, such as Raynaud's praxinoscope, when they were yoked to projection and to the lantern platform. When placed in a theater, projected motion pictures became known as the cinema. And in this respect, the stereopticon and the cinema, what at first went under a wide variety of names, right? The vitascope, the biograph, the cinematograph, etc., were combined innovations in the field of photography, where both the stereopticon and modern motion pictures, the cinema, were combined innovations in the field of photography with the lantern platform. The stereopticon failed to establish itself as a media form. Why, how, and when did motion pictures? Of course, one reason is that motion picture production and exhibition required its own unique technologies, special cameras, printers, projection equipment to be placed in front of the lantern and so forth, right? Unlike the stereopticon, which could, any kind of slide, not just a photographic slide, could be put in the stereopticon. Basically, only motion picture film, and in fact, a very specific kind of motion picture film, could be used in any particular projector. It was not only, the cinema, if you will, was not only an intersection of various practices. It became immediately its own practice. It was its own practice from the outset. As is often the case with so-called chicken and egg questions, it's really impossible to determine which came first. As the system of motion picture production and exhibition was invented, motion picture practices constituted itself. In this respect, I disagree with André Gaudreau. Cinema did exist from the outset. Motion pictures also transformed so many different fields of endeavors: photography, theater, sports, politics, news and the newspaper, the arts, and eventually religion and science. And it transformed social mores in our daily lives as well, of course. Although cinema's biggest immediate impact was on screen practices, as we have seen, the stereopticon hardly disappeared overnight, but in fact continued to expand. Nevertheless, even during its initial introduction, cinema created a series of disruptions that anticipated later transformations. There are a number of films and film programs produced during cinema's novelty period when these disruptions are evident. For instance, the John C. Rice, May Irwin Kiss was one of these. This short film created a whole series of disruptions as the cinematic tale wagged the theatrical dog and turned John C. Rice into a middle-aged kissing star. Another was the Biograph Company's official debut in October 1896, which was also a major Republican campaign rally. So cinema in the 1896 presidential election. Given that commercial projected motion pictures were only a few months old, it's perhaps surprising that they played a prominent, a circumscribed role in the 1896 presidential election between Republican William McKinley here and Democrat William Jennings Bryan over here. However, because New York City was the center of the nascent film industry and pivotal in terms of the election, this conjunction facilitated a dynamic engagement. Certain Republicans remained interested in exploring innovative ways to use the lantern platform in their campaign. Bryan was a renowned orator, and one reason William McKinley conducted what was called a front porch campaign from his home in Canton, Ohio. It was the best way to avoid a head-to-head comparison of their rhetorical talents. McKinley was convinced that if he went head-to-head with Bryan, that he would probably lose. It was not coincidental, then, that the Republican candidate's brother, Abner McKinley, was an investor in the most ambitious of the new motion picture enterprises, the American Mutoscope Company. The Biograph had its official premiere on Monday evening, October 12th, at Hammerstein's Olympia Music Hall on Broadway between 44th and 45th Streets. As McKinley at Home was shown for the first time, this was a Biograph film that the Biograph Company shot of McKinley on it in front of his front porch, where he was conducting his front porch campaign. Now, October 12th, this is just under a month before the election. And elections back in those days were comparatively brief. So this was like as the election was really going into overdrive. And Hammerstein's Olympic Music Hall on Broadway between 44th and 45th Street, this is important because I My apartment's on 45th Street and two blocks away. But unfortunately, the Olympia Music Hall is no longer there because it's America, right? Or New York. But it was also, so this official debut of the Biograph, and actually was not the real debut. The Biograph had been sort of doing a kind of out-of-town tryouts for a month before, you know, working out the kinks before this very high-profile debut. It was also a political rally. And that morning, the New York Herald initiated the feedback loop between event and newspaper coverage by running four line drawings from instantaneous photographs taken for the Biograph to be exhibited at the Olympia Theater under the auspices of the Republican National Committee. These images were said to illustrate incidents in Major McKinley's life in Canton, Ohio. While Biograph's program of films at the Olympia consisted of a number of attractions and so seems to conform to Tom Gunning's cinema of attractions paradigm, it's hard not to feel that such a label conceals as much, if not more, than it reveals. The filmmaker's careful organization of one-shot films produced a highly effective political rhetoric. Biograph's showmen not only constructed this film program around principles of variety, but more importantly, those of associational and contrast editing. The final program has as much affinity to Eisenstein's concept of montage of attractions as it does to cinema of attractions. Eisenstein saw montage of attractions as a new editing form in which arbitrarily chosen images, independent from the action, would be presented not in chronological sequence, but in whatever way would create the maximum psychological impact. Thus, the filmmaker could aim to establish in the consciousness of the spectators the elements that would lead them to the idea he wanted to communicate. He should attempt to place them in the spiritual state or the psychological situation that would give birth to that idea. So as an exhibition service, Biograph programmed, sequenced, and edited these short films. And they did so to powerful calculated effect, which included, I want to note, a test audience. They sort of had a preview on Sunday night, and they actually changed the order of films slightly because it turned out that the order, they ended with the McKinley, but they found out that became a kind of slightly anticlimactic. And so they moved the Empire Express, which had been just before McKinley and Hobart Parade at Canton. They apparently moved it to the end. The program's focus was on the McKinley films. And the New York Tribune reported that the biggest part of the enthusiasm began when a view of McKinley and Hobart Parade in Canton was shown. Hobart was the vice presidential candidate. The cheering was incessant as long as the line was passing across the screen. And it grew much greater when the title of the next picture appeared. I think that's important. Just remember that. Put that aside. When the title of the next picture appeared, that was a lantern slide. The title was Major McKinley at Home. Major McKinley was seen to come down the steps of his home with his secretary. The secretary handed him a paper, which he opened and read. Then he took off his hat and advanced to meet a visiting delegation. So here's a frame enlargement from McKinley at Home. Here's the Empire State Express. Although this is not a frame enlargement, it's just a photograph that I grabbed. Showing a film of the Empire State Express train was a brilliant conclusion. It might be seen as Biograph's version of the advancing prow of the battleship which concluded Sergei Eisenstein's Potemkin. The Empire State is moving full speed ahead for McKinley, or like the express train, the Republican candidate is an unstoppable force. And yet here, American film programs were already ambiguous and open to multiple, often mutually inclusive interpretation. The train was also like Biograph's motion picture system, an impressive technological marvel that was hailed for the absence of flicker and jump noticeable in its competitors. The repetition of the Empire State Express moved the program beyond McKinley, without, however, leaving him behind, to reassert and equate the power of American technology and industry with the Biograph motion picture system, even as the superior technology was linked to the sound money politics of the Republicans. The fortunes, here's McKinley at Home. The fortunes of Biograph's high quality exhibitions and the businessman's candidate were linked. I want to say the motion picture was much better quality than what you're seeing here. This is from a paper print, but we're lucky it's around. So the Fortunes of Biographs, high-quality exhibitions, and the businessman's candidates were linked. No good Republican or upholder of sound money doctrine can afford to miss the lifelike representation of their champion on the lawn of his home at Canton, declared the Mail and Express. Theatergoers who had been distracted by politics were brought back into the vaudeville house as paying customers to glimpse their candidate in the flesh. McKinley's front porch served as a modest counterpart to the Olympia's stage, which it seemed to momentarily replace. McKinley's virtual self served as a surrogate for his absent self. His absent presence could miraculously appear on stage, that is, on screen, at the front of the theater, acting as a relay between the man in Canton himself and the spectators in the theater. This was an astute and an original way to promote both McKinley and the Biograph Exhibition Service. The Biograph's debut at Olympia Music Hall seemingly was a mixture of careful planning and last-minute improvisation. A reliable Republican newspaper only revealed Biograph's coup on the very afternoon of the event. McKinley, who was rooted in Canton, Ohio, was to make an almost miraculous visit to New York City and be greeted by his in-the-flesh vice presidential running mate, Garrett Hobart. So the whole idea was, right, you bring the real vice presidential candidate would be in the theater to greet the McKinley on the screen. This is like how they were going to come together as a kind of a symbol of unity. Moreover, the candidate's beloved homestead would travel with him. Now, it may be that Hobart did not attend in the end, but many prominent Republicans were there. Some were associated with New York Senator Thomas C. Platt, who had opposed McKinley's nomination, would suggest that the event served as a kind of public display of party unity. Other patrons were associated with the New York Central Railroad, and Empire State Express was certainly a film they had sponsored. Now, these people were more directly connected to the Republican event than one might assume, since several of the prominent Republicans were also railroad executives. The event thus brought together powerful business and political representatives who were often one and the same. To follow McKinley with an image of the onrushing Empire State Express was certainly fraught with multiple meanings. The Biograph left Hammerstein's, I have my photographs out of order. That one there was supposed to be down there. The Biograph left Hammerstein's theater unexpectedly after a 2-week run in October and promptly reopened at Koster & Biles Music Hall on October 26th, again with little advance notice. As election day approached, political demonstrations reached a fevered pitch inside as well as outside the theater. McKinley's silent virtual self was once again one of the candidate's most effective surrogates and turned an evening at the theater into a campaign rally. If we consider the Biograph's presentation in terms of lantern performances, the screening revived the sense of immediate presence that audiences experienced when first witnessing the Stereopticon. Each also offered a juxtaposition of various images, though it's not clear how the earlier lantern slides were sequenced. At the same time, the program did not make use of a lecturer, something that was not always the case with other film screenings in 1896-1897. In this and other ways, the program broke from earlier Republican uses of projected images, in which, if you will, the image was meant to serve the rhetoric of the speaker. Here, the rhetoric was contained within the films themselves. Nevertheless, it would be a mistake to isolate these changes within a narrow genealogy of screen practice, as I have been guilty of doing in the past. So here's a kind of assessment, that this new 1896 media formation was transformative rather than additive. One way to assert this is to consider the change relationship between political and theatrical cultures. Cinema moved political theater into New York's entertainment venues, a place where politicians had rarely gone in previous elections. It was not only that their virtual selves made appearances in these theaters, or because there actually was also a film made by the Edison Company of Bryan, which I have not gone into. It was not that their virtual selves made appearances in these theaters. On the same program as Risque Dancing Girls, breaking down some of the distinctions between the platform of political oratory and the realm of amusement, the dynamic between press and political culture was transformed as well, expanded to include the theater in ways that would prove potent. Those who saw McKinley and his front porch in the music halls read newspapers about him and the delegations that came to express their homage. One lengthy report in the New York Sun suggested that McKinley was a humble man, adored by citizens who made the pilgrimage to Canton. It is they who provided the dynamism while he offered stability. These news items avoided the specifics of policy and party, carrying such headlines as McKinley preaches hope. He says he has no part in the doctrine of hate. The people against the bosses was one of his 1896 campaign slogans. Predictably, of course, he embraced patriotism. Stand up for America and America will stand up for you, he told the Republican Press Association of West Virginia. The mute motion pictures of McKinley, its virtual but disembodied presence, had a vision-like quality that made McKinley seem momentarily transcendent. Properly contextualized, which was Biograph's achievement, it provided an effective icon which could be endowed with these sentiments, with a new sincerity and power. I don't know how much I cut here. I'm going to say that what these films were designed to do was to avoid the issue of the tariff and other issues that would divide the electorate, right? So you preach the homilies of hope. And of course, you followed the U.S. election. Who more recent? What recent presidential candidate used hope as a kind of, uniting not only Americans with fellow Americans, but with all of Europe and, in fact, all the world, but our Barack Obama. So, more generally, the politicized feedback loop between vaudeville screenings and the press, which McKinley at home helped to establish, had powerful consequences around events leading up to the Spanish-American War. So newspaper mogul William Randolph Hearst, who showed films on election night at his headquarters, funded the taking of war films in the winter and spring of 1898. And these pictures of the sunken battleship Maine and the like were shown in vaudeville theaters, which served as a space where citizens could express Cold War sentiments that were being fostered by the jingoistic press. These newspapers in turn covered these spontaneous patriotic displays as evidence of American desires for intervention, thus helping to impel the U.S. to war with Spain in April 1898. In short, I guess what I'm suggesting is that the Biograph Company, with this, the political rhetoric here around the campaign of 1896, provided a model which was applied later on, which actually got the United States, did a lot to get the United States into war. So it's not just an isolated phenomenon. It had further implications. So pro-McKinley and pro-imperialist forces had control of this new media form and used it very effectively. To do this, one might add, exhibitors structured their programs of short one-shot films in ways that made effective use of the exhibitors' control of editorial method, the construction of narrative, the use of contrast for inflammatory purposes, and the careful juxtaposition of image and word when wanted. The political-oriented feedback loop between audiovisual projection and the press had already been well established for campaign purposes in 1892 and was one element of continuity between these two formations. However, the shift from long-form screen programs involving the projection of slides, that is, non-moving images in 1892, to a selection of short, one-shot moving image projections was part of a more far-reaching transformation. The illustrated lecture focused on the central political issue, emphasizing policy of programs, not personality. In contrast, the two films of McKinley and Bryan were silent as to specific programmatic content, but featured personalities and showed the essence of their campaign styles. In this respect, they might be considered pregnant instances along the lines discussed by Maria Todajada. That is, they were films of moments that captured the dominant or representative essence of their campaign. McKinley was always at home, Bryan seemingly always campaigning from a train, and the film of Bryan was Bryan giving a talk from the rear end of a train. Bryan on train in Orange, New Jersey, something like that. So sound money Democrats who supported McKinley despite their traditional party allegiances were able to embrace a personality rather than a set of developed policy agendas addressing the tariff and other issues for which they continued to have serious reservations. The move from political oratory to political pageantry and the embrace of the bicycle, the first use of the telephone for news gathering on election eve, and even the initial adoption of the phonograph by McKinley campaign, by McKinley's campaign, contributed to a notable transformation of prior media practices. The move away from discourses of sobriety and long forms, which included a number of other films that were made in this period that had political implications or electoral implications, was one dimension of this reformulated usage of media forms. These unauthorized or grassroots expressions of political sentiments attacked the Bryan campaign, asserting an affinity between McKinley and Cleveland on one hand, and an incompatibility of the working classes and Bryan on the other. These were, again, free of programmatic content. So in any case, they used these other films, which I haven't really discussed, but nonetheless, they used popular forms with affinities to mass circulation dailies. The performance of a lightning sketch, for instance, by an artist whose illustrations appeared in the New York Evening World, and this sort of spoof of McKinley's was really a comic strip-like farce that, again, sort of something that was very similar in structure to what you'd see in a newspaper. There was thus certainly another aspect of the new interplay or feedback loop between the screen and the press. So, can you stand one last little piece? Okay, this is like, when did cinema become cinema? So when did cinema become cinema? Let me just say that motion picture practices were changing rapidly throughout this period until about 1920, and probably beyond that. So I'm instinctively resistant to the notion that cinema did not become institutionalized until about 1910. And this is something that André Gaudreau was talking a lot about, and I have to say that I have not sat and read carefully exactly what he says, but it's just like when he uses this date, 1910, the hair on my back bristles. Cinema became a form of mass communication, and so mass entertainment and culture, in 1908, with the introduction of the regular release schedule and the emergence and an emergent mode of representation that, through the use of intertitles and a strong linear form of narrative organization, was more accessible and consistent in its meaning. So that's 2 years before 1910. In 1905, 1906, the Nickelodeons provided cinema with its own specially designated exhibition sites. I mean, if cinema is cinema, if cinema has its own exhibition sites, it seems to me it's pretty much cinema, right? To have specialized motion picture houses or cinemas, but no cinema, seems odd. If I were to answer this question in a way that was not simply reductive or dismissive, that is, say, when did cinema become cinema? Well, it became cinema in 1895, 1896. What do you think? Huh? I mean, of course. Well, okay, if I'm not going to be flip, but sort of try and take this seriously, I would consider those two moments, 1906, 5, 6, and 1908, important potentially. But I'd also like to look at a series of interconnected changes in the apparatus or dispositive that occurred in mid to late 1903. That would include the introduction of the three-blade shutter, which made spectatorship much more pleasurable by sharply reducing flicker. So you all know about the introduction of the three-blade shutter. This is one of the really important inventions in cinema that no one ever talks about. But by the time you get out of here, you will know that 1903 is the pivotal moment in the history of cinema. And it all has to do, at least in part, with the three-blade shutter. Before this moment, so the three-blade shutter made spectatorship much more pleasurable and sharply reduced flicker. Before this moment, the cutting back and forth between slides and film was not only desirable, but it was common. Right? If you remember that little quote about the Biograph exhibition, they introduced McKinley at home with a slide. So you would go slide, film, slide, film, slide, film. Okay, so it wasn't really cinema that you were seeing. You were seeing a Stereopticon dash cinema exhibition. The title slides did a few things. The title slides gave the eyes of the audience a rest, and also, since motion picture film was very expensive, it also reduced the cost of materials. What this meant was that until 1903, exhibitors who showed films were also showing lantern slides. That is, here it is. Well, look, the motion picture machine and with the stereopticon. So here's the stereopticon, and here's the motion picture part of the apparatus. So if you were an exhibitor, and this is like almost a home toy, so that the others, some of them are much more sophisticated, but this is what I could grab from the web. So you would move back and forth. So you go back and forth between slides and film, and so you could show a title, and then you'd show a film. And so your projector sort of was able to show two incompatible forms of media at the same time, more or less. So the lanterns in this period were stereopticon and moving picture machines combined, in which the exhibitor could swivel his apparatus back and forth as he alternated between the two. In general, this meant that post-production was physically occurring in the course of exhibition. Even as the three-blade shutter was introduced in the United States, the Edison Company began to sell its longer films, noticeably Uncle Tom's Cabin, with head titles and inner titles. So post-production became centralized inside the production company, a process that had begun somewhat earlier but had been impeded by these established exhibition practices. So, you can think of longer films like Life of an American Fireman. In fact, the Edison Company, when McKinley was shot and they had his funeral, they had a series of short films, but they also could give you one long film in which there were dissolves between the individual short films, so that you could, in fact, show one long film of McKinley rather than going back and forth between slides and film. But that was only one option. They always left it up to the exhibitor. In any case, these were considerations about why, in fact, you might want to give your audience let them rest their eyes, et cetera. You could also draw out an exhibition by showing lantern slides. They would be cheap. You might call fill. I guess they would be called B-roll today or something. Once the projectionist was simply so post-production became centralized inside the production company, a process somewhat earlier but had been impeded by these established exhibition procedures. So you were now selling just a roll. You now just were showing a roll of film. You were no longer showing slides in film. So you were just showing, if you will, you were just showing cinema. You weren't also showing stereopticon and plus cinema, or cinema plus stereopticon. Once the projectionist was simply showing a reel of film, distributors could simply rent a reel of film rather than provide a service which included projectionist, projector, slides, and film. So big surprise, in 1903, the emergence of the rental system began in the United States, in which they would just rent a reel of film. And they'd send it out. In some cases, some of the first exhibitors would send a reel of film to one theater, which would then send it to another theater, which would send it to another theater across the United States. Who knows what it was like when it got to San Francisco, but you no longer had to rent an entire service. So also, it was at this moment that narrative fiction began to dominate in vaudeville and elsewhere. Despite all the talk about cinema attractions going to 1906, there's lots of documentary evidence, if you read The Emergence of Cinema, that the story film became dominant in the second half of 1903, at this very moment. So, and this, it seems to me, was for a number of reasons, that nonfiction films was becoming tiresome. There was a kind of crisis around the all-too-familiar recurrence of similar nonfiction films. And the solution to this problem was narrative, in and of itself. But narrative now... Fiction films became much more pleasurable to watch. Remember, they were also much longer. Why? Because of the comparative absence of flicker. As a result of this increase of pleasure that moving picture houses could be created and given names such as Bijou Dream and Dreamland. This shift also meant that lanterns were redesigned just to show films. This was a decisive moment, but not the only moment when cinema became cinema. When projections and vaudeville houses only showed films as part of the program, and when audiences only saw motion pictures as part of the motion picture program. This is very much in contrast to the stereopticon, where the projectors were used to show a variety of representational formats. Moreover, as was the case with the Biograph programs of the 1890s, exhibitors were not used to illustrated lectures. This is I was writing just as I had to come over here. Well, I think I'll skip over that. It's just, in short, what I think I'm trying to say here is that these suggest that, you know, the reasons why the Stereopticon failed in the aspirations to be a media form, while the cinema, which had similar aspirations, or the practitioners of the Stereopticon, the lovers of the Stereopticon and the lovers of cinema had similar aspirations, but one of those aspirations was disappointed and the other aspiration came true. And I think it's these the differences between the medias and the evolution, so that as the Stereopticon became more familiar and used more widely, it was used more widely with other kinds of media forms. While cinema, after 1903, basically it was only cinema. Oh, and so we end up with a cinema projection like this, right, which was only designed to show motion pictures. So this is trying to think about how the Stereopticon and cinema, while they had certain similarities and certain, particularly in their novelty in their first years, you know, many remarkable similarities, you know, in the end they went in very different directions. So thank you for listening to this slightly disorganized presentation.
Thank you very much to Charles and Rosa. So many, many cool, very questions. Just first, I ask a question about the world. This clue that you say that the institutionalization of the cinema, your organs, the idea that it is in the tent, it's related to the fact, I think, do you think I would make this hypothesis.
Okay. Yes.
Is
you're speaking Andre Gaudreau right now.
Yes.
Yes, please.
And you complete the which way to do that. So perhaps it's in the tent that the reception is tightening to prove that cinema is an art, and and it's that's one of the reasons. I think it's one of the reasons of the internationalization of cinema. Around this question, cinema is an art, cinema is an institution of art. And it's very interesting your proposal, because it's around the mass media and the economic position, and it changes the date.
Uh-huh.
Do you think it's this move from the question of art to the question of economics and mass communication, mass information? Using of media in this context that changes in the growing history of cinema, that the institutionalization is becomes in before.
Well, I mean,
do you think it's related? There is a relation to.
Well, you know, I think the thing is that cinema is constantly changing, right? So, and I don't mean just, you know, I mean, you know, I know the term progress is seen as suspect, but there is a way in which there's this engine of change which we can think of as a certain kind of progress, you know, that continues at least until 1920 with a vertically integrated studio system. You know, so for a long time it was like the classical Hollywood cinema, you know, by favoring mode of representation, which is what David Bordwell, Kristen Thompson, and Janet Steiger do. They say the classical Hollywood cinema falls into place in 1917. So 1917 is the date. Well, you know, if you want to talk economically, you could say it's the vertical integration of the studio system around 1920. And in fact, some people said that, you know, that the system of representation from 1917, you know, becomes deeper and is much more in place, in fact, by 1920. Yes, you can see all the techniques in 1917, but it's really by 1920, around 1920, that they become fluent. And that's also the, you know, the beginning of the vertically integrated studio system. Well, 1910, you don't have feature films yet, so is, you know, that means, you know, the short film, you know, has real limits in terms of art. You know, so So I don't know. I mean, you know, Andre. He gets, you know, he can say it, and everyone will march and, you know, march behind Andre. But I just, you know, I knew Andre when I still, you know, a student came to me who was from Canada, and she was working in this area, and I said, "Oh, you're Canadian. You live in Montreal. I'll tell you when you go up, I'll go see Andre Gaudreau." And so I wrote Andre, and I said, "Andre, this student of mine is going to come up. She's going to see you." And much later, Andre said, "You know, your student never came to see me." And I said, "Oh, really? I don't know why." Well, you know, so I went and I talked with the student. She said, "You don't expect me to go and just knock on Andre Gaudreau's door, do you? I mean, he's as famous." You know, which made me feel great. I was just her faculty member. You know, she gave me a hard time when I gave her a hard time about some local politics. But anyway, so Andre seems to be, but I just don't, you know, and likewise, I mean, this whole thing about cinema of attractions, you know, people stop looking at what's actually going on, you know? I mean, you know, Tom Gunning talks about how, well, cinema of attractions is the dominant system of representation. But what happens is that, you know, start looking at the things that aren't dominant. I mean, first of all, you might find so much stuff that is in the non-dominant category that the dominant category may no longer be dominant in that way. But also, you know, because we think of cinema of attractions, we no longer have to think about anything else, right? So you can look at this program. Whoops. It's coming up. There it is. You can look at this program and you can just see it as, oh, what a good example of cinema of attractions, without understanding that in fact this was highly effective political rhetoric. That this replaced, you know, everyone got together because this was like more effective than a lecture, than a political campaign speech, right? And you know, I could go into it, but you know, you have, you know, Rip Van Winkle, the all-American play, a hard wash, this is nice, you know, America has a race problem, and a hard wash demonstrates that there's nothing more American than good old American racism. It's a black woman washing her baby to try and get it clean, which of course doesn't work, ha 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 ha, very funny. Niagara Falls is, of course, America's great natural beauty. There's nothing, you know, you have the Matterhorn, but we have Niagara Falls, and let me tell you, we really beat you guys, you know? Yes, I know you drool, you know, but anyways, I'm being facetious here, but Niagara Falls, American beauty. And then, of course, this parade, you know, is you know, in a republic, there's a Republican parade on the screen, in a Republican, for a Republican house. And then I did go in a little bit about the relationship between McKinley at Home and the Empire State Express. But, you know, one can go, you know, even up here, Niagara Falls, you know, we get the upper rapids, so the water gets moving really fast here, and then it's going to actually go over the falls here. And it's sort of, so it's like we're building to a crescendo here. So the whole order of films is like very, very carefully crafted. This is brilliant editing. If you are a film editor, you should look at these. You can imagine, you know, like that editing was not like something that people didn't know about in 1896. They fully understood the way in which film could be manipulated to have an impact on the audience. And that's just not the way. Cinema of Attractions is about sort of seeing these films as self-contained entities, as, you know, attractions and sort of miscellanea and variety, and that's not what was happening here at all. So I don't know, you know, and then, you know, Andre Gaudreau, I mean, sorry, Tom Gunning will say that that a trip to the moon, you know, Méliès is only interested in the tricks, you know, he's not interested in the narrative, you know, but you can find D.W. Griffith saying he's only interested in color or something, you know, he's not interested in the story, you know, I mean. You know, you can say that, like, you can find filmmakers at any given time telling you that they're not really interested in the story at all, they're really interested in the special effects or whatever. But in fact, these are people go to see these films. I mean, in part because of the story. Of course, they always have other components, whether they're the actress or actor that you're in love with, or my wife, any film with George Clooney in it, that George Clooney is the attraction. Doesn't matter, it's true. It does not matter about the story. The story is unimportant. If George Clooney is in the picture, that's it. Perfect, for every moment he appears on the screen, that's another attraction, right? So, Cinema of Attractions has not changed at all. You just have to love George Clooney. The struggle over films placed in the larger culture, reaches a certain, intensity in that period, but it actually starts in 1906. You can certainly see it in place by 1908. I think that what we should try and do is understand each of these different moments, right? What does it mean when you have, in 1908, when you have a regular release schedule? I mean, I didn't come up with this sort of definition of mass communication, but cinema fits the kind of definition that's being ballied around in communications departments in 1908 and not before, and not obviously not all of motion pictures at any moment. So that seems to me to be pretty important. I can just repeat what I just repeated. I mean, all these moments, it seems to me, are really important. Why not try and understand what each of them is doing? I mean, I think, I don't want to privilege 1903 over all these others, but I do think that since 1903 is not a year that people talk about very much, that, it's worth pausing to think about that. From a technological viewpoint, it does mean something that at that moment people are just projecting films and not also slides. I'm just repeating myself. Sorry.
Another question.
I'll be briefer in my response.
Do you have other examples of attraction montage like that?
Yeah, the first Vitascope program is also a narrative, and I've actually written about it in a number of different places. I think what happens in these programs, and like particularly with a Vitascope, by even a few months later, is there so much pressure to put in new films that the coherence of those vaudeville programs of short films begins to break down as they really do become a form of cinema of attractions, because what's important is getting the latest films in. But then, I'm not saying that cinema of attractions is always wrong. I mean, it works in a lot of cases. But when you get to the Spanish-American War and the way in which films was being used as a kind of goading the American public to war, again, it becomes a highly organized form of political rhetoric. There's this wide range of how films are being used. And in some cases, these short films are building blocks for narratives. So it's not, so this kind of highly charged political rhetoric on one hand, narrative on another, there's a variety of ways in which film programs were constructed in the 1890s. And, I think what I like to be interested in is the range, from this to here. And maybe it's not just like from here to here, maybe it's here to here to here to here. It may be quite, if you were to map it, the range of possibilities, they might be quite rich. And I think it just goes with I don't think that we think the people who invented the internet like didn't know how to use it. But of course they couldn't. It's like if you look at the internet today, you say, God, those guys were stupid. Why didn't they think of, something? Well, that wasn't where things were.
I'd like to go back to the stereopticon. There's one thing I'm not quite sure if I understood that, or right. Maybe I missed that. If the term stereopticon was right. Actually a direct reference to the stereoscope or to stereoscopic views,
yeah.
Or if that is just your interpretation. or if you can really prove that this is the actual reason why it was called like that.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, they what they literally did was, I mean, yeah, very, very explicitly that it was stereoscopic views that were that were two glass things that they were cut in half, and then, I mean, there are references in catalogs and Magic Lantern journals and other things that say specifically that that's what they were doing. So I mean, they. Right, and the slides could be used for both purposes.
Yeah, about that, to come back to this, what is very striking here, and what we are interested in here too, is the link between discourses and technology. And
right.
Here we have an example, very striking, in which the stereopticon refers to stereoscope, but has very few concrete technological links or even perceptual links for the spectator. And on the other hand, the link is that there is this relocation thing which you talk about, which is the sort of illusion of being there, which would be the link for the spectator, justifying keeping the term stereopticon, even though it's not stereoscopic anymore, from
right.
what I could understand. And then there's this cut between two, the magic lantern and the stereopticon, which are just the same object, but not used the same way, and
right.
so there's different, completely different perception of the object. So that's that two levels working here, the discourse
right.
and the technological, very curiously articulated here, and differently in the U.S. and in the U.K., and that's very striking too.
Yeah, I sort of knew that that was the case, but until I really did this sort of search, I didn't realize it was, you know, the random word access, or that it would line up in such a, either line up so neatly or display so neatly, I guess. But right, I absolutely agree that that's, you know, what's interesting, what's going on, or some of the things that are going on in this. So I need to. You know, I want to go back and find out how many times the term lecture was used in these decades, and I bet you it was in the thousands, or even tens of thousands. It was a really, really common term, and it'll put things in perspective. But thank you for I want to just say one thing, that I think that there was, you know, when we think of it in relationship to the stereoscope, we say, okay, there's not any sense of, it's not the kind of three dimensions, right? But for them, seeing a photograph projected with a sharp lens and a bright light on a screen gives a sense of depth. I mean, when we see films, we do see depth, you know, in a way. I mean, and of course, the jury's still out about whether we're going to all move to 3D motion pictures or not. But
I was interested by this too, because I've been working on KinemaColor, the first natural color photographic systems, and in these discourses on these processes, there's always the idea of the stereoscopic effect.
Mm-hmm.
When you have color, you have stereoscopic effect, and when you have natural color, you have really a stereoscopic effect. That in the discourses, in the comments, in the newspapers as well as in the manuals, it's always very important. And the presence of this stereoscopic idea in discourses on color
right.
is surprising. It shows also the presence of this stereoscopic idea in the field
right.
in general.
That is really interesting. I mean, because, you know, here you always think that they're putting it against paintings or lithography, you know, where they're, you know, different, you know, but color is still, I mean, you're talking about continued photographic. And I think even if we were to look at it today, at a film today, we might think that black and white is better able to manipulate a sense of depth through lighting than color. I mean, we might actually think this, the reverse is true. So it's interesting, yeah. So it's not just, you know, I mean, the discourse is related also to right, the subjective impressions of the audience and as being suggested and promoted by the very people who are trying to sell the product. Well, we kept them long enough?
Just finish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh,
no?
Sorry.
I just a question. Last
yeah, okay.
Finish if there is another one. Just your conclusion, you are finishing on the soul, unique cinema. But don't you think that the cinema, even institutionalized, is in the history of 20th century, again, reactivated in other dispositives, in other
right.
in art, in TV, nowadays in the web, you have the first two.
No.
Isn't it another way of crossing dispositives, as you show for Theopticon, which is not yet institutionalized, and
right.
will never be institutionalized, but it seems your conclusion gives me an idea of a sort of conclusion
yeah.
of institutionalization in cinema alone in the 20th century. But even institutionalization can be reorganized and
right.
transformed by other practices of cinema, which is not only.
Or
you would agree with that?
Well, the media formation is constantly changing, and I think that what you're suggesting, and something I think is, there is this notion that you know there's this sort of episteme 1900, and then another one in 2000, and what's sort of in between from like I don't know 1920 to 1960 is like a period of relative stability,
no.
right?
No.
But you know, there's sound, there's color, there's radio, there's television, there's radar. I mean, and the telephone. I mean, so that it's never stable. The reality is like that media formations are constantly changing, and cinema within them. And this notion that really most of all comes from, well, maybe Bazin through David Bourbon and Kristen Thompson, that cinema is a classic art. It's a period of stable, which means a certain stability. You know, and so we have the classical Hollywood system, and the system is sort of at the very least in place from 1917 into the 1960s and beyond. It just, you know, it just doesn't really work that way so well, I think. I mean, right? So it's, you know, this is the danger of things like, well, cinema is institutionalized. Well, I mean, in some ways, like I'm saying, on one level, it was institutionalized the moment it was started because, you know, there was a group of people who had to learn, had to create, and then had to use a technology which made, you know, was maybe a basis of a very kind of institution, and then it got spread out. You know, so, I mean, you know, what does it mean to be institutionalized? I mean, that's, you know, penetrating more into the culture, but, I mean, it's, you know, in that sense, I think cinema or cinema-related things are, you know, continuing to permeate more and more. I mean, even now, I mean, through the internet, digital video, I mean, makes it so much more easy to, I mean, like all you use cell phones, right? It's cell phone, most of you have cell, how many of you have cell phones that which you could take videos? See, it's like, I mean.
I don't.
Well, I know, and I don't either, but it's like, this goes beyond, you know, yes.
But you, I want to exaggerate a little bit, but you seem to underline like a rupture in your talk when you showed how the politics were using cinema.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between the use in the period of the Theopticon
right.
and then of cinema, you seem to underline like a kind of paradigmatical rupture of
right.
the public sphere and
mm-hmm.
of how the other media is related to cinema,
mm-hmm.
like as a paradigmatic new entry.
Right.
So.
Well, I think that was like a moment of a sort of a flash, a disruptive force. But you know the and film, you know, by the 1910s. Candidates had campaign films and campaign biographies, and this became sort of standard. But there was only one time that motion pictures really probably made a difference in the outcome of the presidential election, which was perhaps not entirely ironically, but maybe some ways ironically, 1948, which was just, 1949 was when television would become a dominant media form in terms of audiovisual media form. So, you know, at the very last moment, you know, and in case this interests you, what happened was Harry Truman, who had been Roosevelt's vice president, became president. So he didn't have a kind of, he hadn't won on his own, right? He didn't have a track record. And after the war, there were all kinds of economic and other dislocations, so he was very, very unpopular. And the person he was running against, Dewey, it was just assumed that Dewey was going to win. You know, I mean, he was in terrible, terrible shape. And Dewey had someone make a campaign film for him, The Dewey Story. And Hollywood was still basically Republican. It was Republican in 1890, movies were Republican in 1896, and they were basically Republican in 1948. And so all the Hollywood studios put The Dewey Story into the theaters. And Truman was furious. You know, I mean, he was going to lose. Everyone agreed he was going to lose, but he wasn't going to be insulted this way. And so Hollywood was very apologetic. They, you know, because they were worried that, you know, they would offend the Democrats and that something might happen because of the power. So they made The Truman Story, and they sort of made it on the cheap using news footage, and it went into the theater the week before the election. And according to Truman's campaign manager, that was the turning point. No, you know, there's this famous photograph from a newspaper front page which says Dewey wins. Because everyone was so convinced that Dewey was going to win, that they just put it up in advance. But the fact was that one reel, The Truman Story, in all the movie theaters in the country for the week before the election, this was before television, right? This, you know, and Dewey and Truman carried New York State by like 1,000 votes. I mean, like the election in certain. In certain states was just really like a very, very, you know, where it's, you know, it wasn't like a landslide where you say, well, it wouldn't have made any difference, but it was so close that it's almost certain. So that was really the first time that motion pictures, it seems to me, and the only time the motion pictures really made a huge difference. Was that related to, so this was just a moment of disruption, but I don't think it was a moment of transformation. It was and there's other things I could point to were moments of, they were signs of things to come, but they were connected to like the first experience. It's like the internet. It'll be interesting to see how many of you, do you know, like there were over 1,000 different songs for Obama in the 2008 election on YouTube from all over the world, Japan. There's a little town in Japan called Obama. And so it was like Obama for Obama. It was the Obama song. You know, there were like 8 different songs about Obama from Kenya. There were like, you know, 6 from Jamaica. I mean, it was just from all, there was like this, I'm going to get sentimental here in a moment, but there was this Finnish, no, she was a Swedish minority in Finland who was working as an au pair in England, who sang a song at midnight to like her about Obama. It was, right, it was just crazy. And I tell you, I don't think the internet is going, I don't think you're going to find another 1,000 songs for, new songs for Obama or for, you know, Huckabee or whoever runs against him. I mean, that moment of what the internet was able to do as a new phenomenon, in which you had two candidates with fresh records, I mean, who had never run for president, just like McKinley and Bryan had never run for president. So it was this embrace of the new that can't be repeated, which doesn't mean that the internet's never going to affect elections. I don't think that for all of the marvels of people around the world, you know, Italians on gondolas singing for Obama. You know, you're not going to see that again. But it's an and I don't think that Obama won the election because of the internet. But it was a symbol that he was like, you know, plugged into the 21st century, and that he was an international phenomenon that I think was connected to why he won. But some, but you know, but I doubt the internet is going to be is going to change the outcome of the presidential election in 2012. I don't mean it won't be used. I mean, so it's the same thing. So this is actually how I got started. This is like the, Maria knows that this is like what the talk was that I gave, was comparing these two things. So I could have had you here all night if I'd like done that.
Last question?
No, they want to go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, that was the stuff that I was.